Good morning.
Morning.
It's kind of cozy up in here. So, we're together. That's good. I think so. Happy to be here with you all. I've composed a talk here entitled Love, Interdependence, and Nonviolence. And we have one of my favorite holidays coming up tomorrow, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I think one of the most wonderful reasons we have to celebrate as a nation is what Martin Luther King Jr. embodies or represents for us, in particular in terms of nonviolence. So I want to tell this little story from a book I just read. This book is written by a fellow named, Bryan Stevenson. The book is called Just Mercy. Can't recommend it enough. And in this book, Bryan Stevenson talks about his experience as an attorney, generally representing poor people, often black people, and people who are disenfranchised and not given equal treatment. And he starts off, and he's just sort of poor, and he's defending these people on death row who really their shot has been very marginal. And by the end of the book, he's been arguing cases in front of the Supreme Court. He's a very prominent and influential lawyer. The kind of thing he achieved is he brought a case to the Supreme Court and prevailed, and it set the precedent by which it is no longer possible for children to be executed in the United States or to be sentenced for execution, which happened in the last 20 years. Children being people under the age of 18. But people were being sentenced to death in this country who were 15 and 16 years old until the time of his effort. So that's the kind of thing he does. But he's done a lot of really wonderful and inspiring things. Anyways, it's kind of, I think it's fair to say he's a major dude. You know, once you're arguing in front of the Supreme Court, that's impressive. And towards the end of the book, he says, I used to get these calls from this woman, and her name escapes me. But she was a civil rights leader from Alabama. And this woman, who was at this time quite old, would call him up and say, "Hi, Bryan, I want you to come over tomorrow to my house and listen." And he'd say, "Okay." And he'd go over, and usually she would do this when Rosa Parks was in town, and another friend of theirs, whose name also escapes me, would come. So there'd be these three old African-American women who were civil rights activists, and they would talk, and Bryan Stevenson would listen. And I just love this image of this incredibly prominent, influential lawyer sitting on a porch with three old ladies who are drinking some sweet tea, I'm just going to imagine. That might have been in there, but I might have made it up. And he's just listening. And that's inspiring, you know. So I hope that I can be a person who really listens to those voices that may not always be heard. Maybe it's not apparent to you, but African-American women have not always been the most elevated and listened to people in the United States. So I hope to be a person and to learn to listen and to follow this example. But today, my task is to talk, or at least for the next 40 minutes or 3 hours or whatever. Fasten your seatbelts. So I put a quotation on the bulletin today, a quotation from Rosa Parks, who said, "I would like to be remembered as a person who wanted to be free so that others also would be free." And I'm not going to say Rosa Parks was a bodhisattva, because for all I know, she'd be like, "No, I don't want to be a bodhisattva. I'm Christian." Or maybe she'd say, "That's great. I have no idea. I don't get to ask her." But what I can say is this thing that she spoke is a beautiful expression of what it is about to be a bodhisattva, which is what this organization is intended to promote. Wanting to be free so that others can be free. And not only does the way she put it express bodhisattvahood, but what she did with her life, courageously standing up in the face of massive pain and injustice and just saying, I'm here, I'm not going to hurt somebody, but I'm going to stand up. So, some of you people know I'm all excited about this school of Buddhist thought called Yogacara. So Yogacara is a school of Buddhism that's really deeply connected to Zen, and it's about being a bodhisattva. And Yogacara gives us two principal approaches. One is to take care of the aspects of our emotional experience so that we can benefit everyone, including ourselves. And one is to take care of our cognitive tendencies so that we can take care of everyone. And to put it most simply, the emotional side, we cultivate mind states that are not harmful. So we let go of mind states that are harmful, like hatred, and we cultivate states that are beneficial, like love. And on the cognitive side, we realize interdependence. We realize connection. So, love and interdependence are at the heart of what I recommend that we do here. So, MLK once said, at the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. So, love here, you know, love means a lot of things to a lot of people. So, and actually, if you read ancient Buddhist texts, the word love is usually used in a negative way. So, everyone hates that. Oh, well. Buddhism is always here to just be like, yeah, good vibes. It's challenging. But the reason that that is the case is that love is being used to describe attachment. So, and love is also often, some meanings of the word love are really bound up with attachment, desire, you know, like, I love pizza, you know. It's not a very altruistic expression. So, but love can also mean something that is very different. And this is the kind of love that you see consistently referred to throughout the language of the nonviolent civil rights movement, particularly propagated by African Americans in the United States. So this love, it's not about attachment or desire. It's about compassion. It's about kindness. It's about a natural impulse to act in a way that's beneficial. So, you know, when you have, when people have babies, they often feel like really, really intense emotions. And that's part of the deal. But there's often, a lot of times, just a natural actional love. So, you know, you have your baby's there, and they need something. You just make a little noise. And you just do the thing that is helpful. And you don't have, sometimes, you know, oh, my baby. You know, you're just like, oh, baby's here. You know, because you have a baby around all the time. Half the time, you're like, ah, this goddamn baby. Okay. Well, maybe 10% of the time. I got to go home. But anyway, it's hard. You know, there's negative and positive emotions, blah, blah, all that stuff. But there's these natural motions towards doing something beneficial that happen over and over again that are the only reason that human beings exist. Without that tendency to naturally do something helpful for babies, people wouldn't be here. None of us. So we have this as a capacity, you know. And there's many, many other expressions of this in our lives. Just those little kind things we do for people. We don't think about it a lot. It's a natural expression of our emotional makeup. And these can be cultivated. You know, they occur naturally, but they can be cultivated. So, And, you know, just to tie this in with nonviolence, you know, at the best, in that moment, if a baby starts to feel fussy and you do something helpful, you just do it. And sometimes, if they don't stop being fussy, we're frustrated. That's not nonviolent, ultimately. But if we just go, oh, this is how they are now, and keep helping, that's nonviolence. So if there's no focus on trying to make something other than what's happening, and just focus on action, that's pure nonviolence. Because we're not trying to force something to happen or focusing on making some outcome occur. So anyway, in the letter from Birmingham Jail that Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, he says there are four basic steps to a nonviolent campaign. Collection of facts to determine whether injustices exist. Negotiation. Self-purification. And direct action. So the reason I bring this up here is the self-purification step. And purification is the language that I'm not very interested in. Personally, pure and impure, it's not kind of my bag. But when I look at what he talks about when he talks about this self-purification stuff, it's pretty simple. It's about cultivating love and letting go of hate. Because the thing is, if you try and go in and do a nonviolent thing and you hate the people that you're interacting with, it's going to be really hard at best, possibly impossible. The achievements of civil rights activists in the early 60s, their capacity to meet violence with nonviolence is astonishing. No one has matched that level of spiritual leadership in this country. And there was this self-purification step, which in that case was generally handled religiously. You know, you're going to allow, you know, your understanding of God to help you feel love, to let go of hate. So I don't have any gods. But if you do, go ahead and use them. It's cool. So, self-purification. And, you know, so how are you going to love people in this situation where they're being violent to you or oppressive? Not easy. So, I just read a sermon by Martin Luther King Jr. a couple days ago. And in it he says, the sermon is about loving your enemies. So he's taking the passage from the Bible. It says, love your enemies. Pretty good. We could skip having enemies. You can do it. But, Bible's pretty good. Love your enemies. That's cool. So, he says, quote, now first let us deal with this question, which is the practical question. How do you go about loving your enemies? I think the first thing is this. In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. Martin Luther King Jr. says, in order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. So, and then he goes on and talks about how to do that. So the methodology he suggests is a little different than the methodology we would employ here. And because I'm giving a Zen talk, I'm going to talk about our methodology. But is it not apparent to all of us that the basic methodology that we do here is one of looking at the self and letting it quiet down so that what comes out is less hateful and more loving? I hope that is apparent to everyone. And it is the case that in Dogen's instructions on Zazen, he said to study the way is to study the self. Well, sounds familiar. Or Shto says, turn around the light to shine within. Then just return. But we better turn around this light to shine within, because there's all this stuff going on here. We don't even know what it is that's driving us to act. So if we don't do anything about it, we're going to come out all kinds of sideways. So the thing is, it's possible that there are a bunch of people here who are completely freaked out. I've noticed people are really freaked out right now. Some of them are me. So anyway, so you know, we get freaked out, and, you know, and maybe you're like me. I hear this. Well, I had one of my students came, and he said, you know, I realize that there's all this connection, and there's so much to be done, and what, am I just going to sit? I'm just going to sit and meditate? How does that help? You know, this is a feeling. It comes up. We're sitting on this cushion, and there's so much to do. So that's a common impediment to doing our meditation practice, to doing this self-purification or this self-investigation or just this self-healing or this letting go of hatred and awakening love. But, you know, just sitting down is very important. For one thing, I don't think anyone here is really wrapping up all that much of their life. Like, I'll bet on the outside, maybe the person meditating at this place most meditates like 8% of their life. And most of the people are down at about 1 or 2%. It's going to be okay. You're going to have time to do other stuff. You don't feel like it. We laugh. But you will find yourself going, oh, I can't do a retreat. No way. Jeez, there's so much to get done. But, you know, there's this fellow named Sherto who wrote a song called The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. He's an 8th century Japanese or Chinese Zen monk. And, you know, I liked his poem so much I wrote a book about it. But, so a lot of you have heard me talk about this a lot. And a lot of you have taken in this poem and seen how he shows this life of profound connection and peace and just taking care of simple things. And you go, oh, yeah. Well, what I never really talked about before is that during his lifetime, there was a war in China that killed somewhere between 10% and 60% of the population. And yet, he found this peace. And his commitment to peace resonates 1,500 years later, right now, and through thousands of lives. But he had to do the practice of just sitting down. Even in massive turmoil, our capacity to manifest peace in a simple way is powerful and important. And this sort of connection between an actual engagement with the sufferings of the world and a more reflective, or now I'll shift to calling it spiritual, which is a term I don't usually use for a variety of reasons, but I'll use spiritual now, is expressed really beautifully by someone I think is really great named Michelle Alexander, who is she's an attorney, civil rights attorney and activist. She wrote a great book called The New Jim Crow, which if you haven't read it, and you're not extremely knowledgeable about the massive voter suppression happening in the United States, might be informative. But anyway, she's got a big heart, but she's a great thinker, complex thoughts, lots of active engagement in legal processes. But interestingly, it was just last year she decided to join a seminary, right? Or a theological union. You remember what it is?
Faculty. She became faculty.
Yeah. So she said, oh, I'm going to join this religious organization. So she kind of beautifully expressed this rhythm to me of this relationship between actional, what looks more actional to us, you know, I'm out there being a lawyer, and this more reflective spiritual side of liberating all beings from suffering. So, you know, this is I'm talking about this because it can be a model for our lives. You know, if we want to really be out there in the world benefiting people, which I hope we do, it really helps if we turn around the light to shine within. Find the cushion. Find it daily. Find the community that will support you if you can't find it daily. Come to retreats. Settle all the way down. So, this is this turning around within to create this capacity for this natural love, which isn't about getting things or changing things, but about offering ourselves in the most beneficial way. Love. So then there's this interdependent side. In a letter from Birmingham Jail, Martin Luther King wrote, "I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." Well, for us Buddhists, that might sound kind of familiar. And he puts it so beautifully. You know, I'm quoting MLK a lot because he's just really good at making words that say things beautifully. And nobody's perfect. And many other people have embodied this tradition, but he has a beautiful way with language. So interdependence, interconnection, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. nominated Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Zen monk, who's still alive. Thich Nhat Hanh left the country he was in where he was reviled and kept his life. MLK did not. But, Thich Nhat Hanh was exiled, I think. So anyway, if you know Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching, he's pretty popular. But no one rides the horse of interdependence more than Thich Nhat Hanh. He's really, really into it all the time. I see the sun in the cup. It's beautiful. Wonderful. See the rain and the flowers in everything you see. Realize that this vast universe comes together and connects for everything to be possible. And I can't remember, I'm getting lost in my thoughts here. But anyway, Martin Luther King Jr. nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize in the 60s. So this emphasis on interdependence is basic to feeling like we're supported, but also to feeling like it's worth doing something. That, you know, if what you're doing is just to get things for yourself, it becomes pretty hollow eventually. It gets lonely. But when you realize that your action is connected to everything forever, there's always an opportunity to contribute. So I'm going to shift to, this is a little bit confusing, but hopefully it'll make sense. So in Yogacara thinking, interdependence is really, really heavily emphasized, more so than in any of the preceding schools of Buddhism, although then it gave birth to some extent to a thing called YN, which is like they're just crazy for interdependence, like thousands of pages of interdependence, giant tomes of interdependence, realization. Anyway, So Yogacara emphasizes this, and one way that they do it is they have a set of teachings called the Three Natures. And I'm actually only going to talk about two of them, because the third one is extra confusing. But the first one is the imaginary nature of things, and the second is the interdependent nature of things. So the thing is, the idea is that things have these two natures. Everything that you experience has the nature of being imaginary, and has the nature of being interdependent. So what's really jarring is the imaginary nature is anything that you think it is. Anything that you think or believe it is imaginary. Which, for those of you who have been around Buddhism for a while, is like, yeah, of course. And for the rest of you, is like, you guys are completely crazy. That's cool. Why not? It's okay to be a little, why does this matter? Because if we realize that the processes and lenses through which we view things profoundly affect what they appear to us to be, it can liberate us from being stuck on our viewpoints and being stuck on our alienating positions that hold us in a little box by ourselves, believing that we're right and other people are wrong. So they can be humbling, they can help us listen, they can help us open up, and most importantly, we think, oh no, you're saying everything I believe is imaginary. That's really denigrated it. No, it doesn't denigrate it. It says imagination is amazing. Would you like to train the mind so you can imagine a life that's just an opportunity for love? instead of one where there's all this dissatisfaction and hatred and annoyance? Okay, you guys never have any of that stuff. I know. You can imagine that life. Imaginary nature, by calling everything you conceive and experience through the lens of conception imaginary, it frees you to realize the power you have to imagine something beautiful. But, still, it's not quite right. Otherwise, we wouldn't call it imaginary. So everything also has an interdependent nature. So everything that you see that you're seeing through this lens of all your previously conditioned viewpoints is also just a manifestation of everything in the universe, in the future, in the past, and in all directions, and from the farthest stars to your own heart, is all infinitely connected and dynamically interacting. And it is that dynamic connection that is its interdependent nature. So we don't usually see that, right? You're like driving down the street and you're like, wow, I'm part of that car. No, you're like, get out of my way. Right? Because you put it in a conception that everything is conceptualized in terms of whether you're going to get what you want or not. That's human beings. It's great. So, we're encouraged over and over again to find every possible way to see that interdependent nature, to see that we're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. So, to make a horrifying shift for you all, I'm just going to say a word, and everyone see what happens. Trump. Okay, so maybe we have some people who really think Donald Trump is wonderful. Cool. And maybe we have some people here, it's possible, who don't like Donald Trump very much. I don't know. Regardless, everyone probably has some ideas. Most of you probably know who he is. So have some ideas. You maybe have some emotional tendencies around Donald Trump. Wow. So all that is imaginary. And you may think, no, don't tell me that. I gotta get to my resist meeting. Oh, that's cool. Cool. Go to your resist meeting. That's cool. Or you go to your PAC. You know, he needs some money, I'm sure. So, you know, donate some money. So, regardless, all those ideas and all those feelings you have in this set of teachings is the imaginary nature of Donald Trump. So, but also has an interdependent nature. That is to say, he's infinitely connected to everything, including you. Oh, lucky us. So, now you guys may all hate me by now. That's okay. But why is this helpful? Well, here's the thing. Is what the imaginary nature shows us is we pick tiny pieces of the data of our experience, and we invest huge amounts of cognitive and emotional energy into those. That's what we do with the imaginary nature. And in so doing, we ignore vast amounts of other stuff. And it makes things seem limited to us. Well, the thing is, I'm just going to sort of weigh on the side of the people who are not Donald Trump enthusiasts for the moment. Maybe because there might be more of them here right now. So, the thing is, we think, I hear people say, oh, no, Donald Trump, he's a racist, and he's a sexist, and he's a xenophobe, and he's a demagogue. All right, cool. Well, a lot of categories that fall into what we would call the imaginary nature. Well, the thing is, guess what? Racism has been here in our country all along. Sexism is a pervasive and powerful part of our country that we all are part of. Don't we know that to be true? Xenophobia has been part of our country and human culture probably for all time. There have been dictators all over the world for the last as long as we know. And the thing is, we're already a part of it. And this is where you can really start to hate me. But racism is not something we're separate from. It's part of our culture. We are all already interdependent with it. So our mind wants to put that all on one person and get freaked out about it. But the truth is, we've always been a part of it, and we've always had an opportunity to do something about it. And we still do. The teaching of interdependence shows us that we're always already engaged. And then, instead of hating Donald Trump, if that's your predilection, you have the opportunity to just act when you see this out of love for everyone and realize it's not because some other person is doing something terrible, but because you're part of something that you can contribute to. And we don't like it. Because it's hard. Because, I'm not racist. I don't know if I'm not racist. How would I know that? You look at the most amazing exemplars of liberation from 100 years ago and they look super racist. Don't they? Because it changes. This is the teaching that our understanding of what is really going to be liberated has to keep changing. We have to listen. So we're already intimate with everything. It's already the case. And the problem is Thich Nhat Hanh is way better than I am at teaching. Because he'd be telling you about how you're the sun and the stars. And I'm telling you, you're like, yeah, you're part of mass incarceration. We pay taxes. We pay the taxes. But we can do something. I know it's a hard thing to hear. And maybe you're like, no, that's okay too. You can think whatever you want. But what this shows us, what the teaching of interdependence shows us, is that we can do something. We can always contribute something to this massive interdependence. And this is also just a central basic framework for Buddhism. What's the first noble truth? Suffering. There's lots of it. It's not like, yeah, there's a little bit of suffering, and if you just kind of, you know, learn three weird tricks to end all the suffering in your life. It's big. So, I mean, he shows you the problem is so massive, so you don't get stuck going, oh, if we would have just got Hillary Clinton elected, everything would be fine. Would that end racism? Would that end sexism? Give me a break! And we think these little tiny things are going to be the solution. Buddha says the problem is vast. Vast and interconnected. And yet, the whole point of the Four Noble Truths is you can do something. In the face of the vastness, you have empowerment. You can walk the Eightfold Path and you can contribute to the alleviation of suffering. We can do it. We can do it, and we always have an opportunity. So engagement isn't optional. You know what I mean? People talk about engaged Buddhism. On the one hand, I'm like, I just don't know anyone who's not acting that way, so I have a hard time getting around the term. But on the other hand, it's like the whole teaching of Buddhism is that everything is already always engaged. So you can't not do engaged Buddhism. Of course, on the other hand, there's lots of reasons to talk about engaged Buddhism, but I'm just playing here, so. You're already part. It's wonderful. It's because it's people. It's people with hearts that you can love. So if we already have this intimacy, I think the best thing to do is to enact nonviolence. What does it mean to enact nonviolence? It's about doing things that aren't about breaking or fixing or changing something else, but just about giving love into the system. Putting love into the whole system. So, you know, conquest, fighting, defeating, I don't think it helps that much. But contributing, offering, loving, acting can all be done. You know, the Bhagavad Gita says just make your effort and let go of the result of your action. That is karma yoga. And we need this because otherwise we're all just going to freak out. and give up. You know, people give up. You know, oh, God, I tried so hard to do, you know, they say, I tried so hard in this political campaign and it failed. And we just feel so beaten. Because we were looking at the imaginary nature. We were looking at this small thing conceptualized in a box instead of realizing our effort was part of something infinite and vast. So there's no defeat, no victory, only action. Cesar Chavez said, there is no such thing as defeat in nonviolence. Wow. It's possible. You have to realize nonviolence really deep in your heart to see that, because it's hard to believe. But you can feel it if you turn towards it and cultivate it. Martin Luther King Jr. said, this is the unusual thing about nonviolence. No one is defeated. Everybody shares in the victory. We don't have to harm other people or get one over on them or call them names or make them other. We don't have to. We will. It's okay. We're all going to do it. So let's love ourselves and be kind. But we don't have to. And in the Dhammapada, one of the most central formative texts of the Buddhist tradition, it says, victory begets enmity, the defeated dwell in pain. Happily the peaceful live, discarding both victory and defeat. So, we can get on up and do a life that's true to ourselves and is about connection. Cultivating love, shedding hatred, realizing our interdependence. And the action that comes out of that is nonviolence. Thank you all. All right, well, just a little light reading for the morning. We have some time here, so if people would like to say words, form of questions, observations, personal reflections, please do so. And if you do, please speak loud enough so that everyone will be able to hear you. We have people all over the place. For those of you sitting on the stairs, sending you much love from all the people in the Zendo. I know it's kind of weird, but we're doing our best. So anyway. Yes, please.
There is a book recommended by one of the Zen people here. I don't know if you want me to say his name. But the book is called How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain by Andrew Newberg. And he talks about what you are saying and interconnectedness. And in that book, he talks about how the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, when activity decreases, people are able to forget about themselves and feel the unity. And they totally change their perspective. And they do see the tree and I are one and the same. They experience it. So, and he has some meditation exercises. And it's a wonderful book. Because some people might feel it enlightenment in different ways. Like some people can actually realize, I am God, or I am Allah, or I am Muhammad, I am Buddha. They feel it. Or some people just go and feel the unity. These different things is very interesting.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain.
How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain.
Written by Dr. Lisa Andrew Newberg. And it is really interesting.
Cool. Thank you.
Like a good question.
Can you talk?
But I have a really hard time with the business between craving the attorney to win in court and get these huge civil rights movements and then the idea of nonviolence and not necessarily being attached to victory for the people.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, if I sit here and say this is wonderful, Bryan Stevenson had this, you know, we say victory in court and attained something, and then how does that jibe with the saying, oh, we're discarding both victory and defeat? And I would say I dwell in the realm of the imaginary nature because I'm human, and that's really, it's hard to talk in any other language. So I don't think any of us is going to let go of the idea of accomplishing things. And in fact, most of us don't have the ego strength or the ego dissolution strength, that's not putting it very well, to not have successes and have them feed ourselves. So, you know, we have to, you know, we need some love. We need some, like, oh, you know, I tried this and it worked out. We're just humans. So what I'm talking about here isn't like you should let go of all everything forever. It's an invitation to open up to a greater letting go, if that makes sense.
Isn't that more like hanging on to things loosely instead of grasping and then just being responsible for your effort, but not the outcome?
Yeah, responsible for the effort, not the outcome. That's pretty good. I don't know who came up with that. Bunch of drunks, I think. For real? Yeah. It's a recovering person expression, and it's very beautiful. Very simple. Simpler than that one from the Bhagavad Gita. Yes.
Comment. Many of us are going to the Women's March in Washington on Saturday, and I resonate with what you were saying because I don't know, have any idea what will come out of that, but I think what many of my friends and colleagues who are going are feeling like, I just want my body in that place and have that sense of being in, together in this space with really not knowing completely what we want out of it, but knowing that it is being that is so important.
Mm. Yeah, so we're saying going to the Women's March and just, we don't know exactly what even outcome we want or could expect, but just being together is good. I'm fixing to be there, so come on down. And yeah, not knowing is good. I think that was in there. It's good to not know. We don't like, it's kind of uncomfortable, but it's good to not know. Any, oh, hello, yes.
I just want to say thank you for setting a tone for the year, well, year and beyond, listening and this reflective and motivated effort and motivated to choose our efforts wisely.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, maybe this is heavy. Maybe it's heavy, but what can I do? In my life, it's not heavy. This practice is a joy. It's liberating. It can be kind of hard to look at this, but it's harder to look away. To yet again use the language of the recovering people, 12-step people, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. They're not saying that doing recovery with 12 steps is easy. They're saying it's just a little better than the other thing. So this isn't magic. We're not going to come here and be like, we got the pill for you. And yet, it's just a little bit better. And that's pretty good. It's pretty good. For the people around you to be just a little bit better. For yourself to be just a little bit better. For all those people that you don't even know whose lives are ineffably touched by what you do, to be just a little bit better can feel pretty darn good. And we don't know exactly how. So, let's have a little tea and feel free to give your friends hugs and get ready to enact your interdependence.
That was a beautiful talk, thank you. I feel like I've been thinking about so many of these things, but here's something that may seem a little goofy, but like about how what we are, our kindnesses that we just take with us in the world. And it has to do with driving, because I think you mentioned it. Because driving to work, there's a daycare where you can just drive right through, and these people got their little kids and they're trying to cross in the middle of the block. And used to be people just drive. And I swear, there's something after this election, people have started stopping for those people. Like the bus has stopped. And they're going to let those people with their little kids go. And the other places when I've been driving, it's like, that person got out of my way so I could turn. You know, I don't know. It might be my imagination, but it's sort of like driving. It's like, people are like going, yeah, you're there, and I'm going to signal, and I'm just going to recognize your existence. And
all right. Well, that's cool. That's your paying attention. I'd like to do that too. So let's do it together. Thank you all very much.